We're also very lucky to have Jose, because many of my students know his work ranges over a very, very broad area of international law. And it is almost uniformly excellent, whether he's talking about foreign investments or war crimes or international organizations or NAFTA. We're also fortunate to have him because he is the president-elect of the American Society of International Law and not the president, as the advertisement said. And we're also very lucky to have him because he thought he was speaking in the old Vic tonight in my initial communications with him. So we should have had Kevin Spacey directing this whole thing, but we've got me instead. Thank you very much for coming to London to speak to us, so very welcome.
Thanks.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, whether or not it's the old Vic or not. I'll have to wait for my next life. Whenever I'm introduced as the president-elect of the society, unless something happens to me, I will become president in April, which is the centennial of the society. I'm always tempted to say that given current events in the United States, I'm becoming president just in time of the society that dare not speak its name. At least in my country, international law seems to be a bad thing. But I'm not going to be talking about U.S. exceptionalism or some of those issues, although it comes up indirectly in this talk. The talk is really about international organizations, as you heard, as lawmakers, and it grows out of my attempt to teach the course on international organizations a long time ago, starting in 1983. And what I noticed was, and I apologize for using these things, I think they distract more than anything else, but since there is no board, I thought that I would just use this as a quick hand thing. Don't focus too much on this. But basically the idea was that I was teaching international organizations and I had a problem in that most of the materials out there on international organizations, and what I'm talking about are those organizations generally created by treaty that aspire to global participation, such as those of the UN system, international financial organizations like the IMF or the World Bank or the WTO. And what I found was that how these organizations affect international law was not really very well dealt with in the literature. In fact, what I was trying to describe to my students was a better description of what these organizations do, a sort of theoretical basis for what is it that they are about and how to understand them from a theoretical standpoint, and also to at least begin to think about what are prescriptions for how these organizations ought to be engaged in lawmaking and not just how they come to be engaged. And the reason for my dissatisfaction was when I took a look at, and I apologize in the surroundings to cite Ian Brownlee, but I love the book, honestly, except that when it comes to institutions or international organizations, I wasn't quite satisfied with the three or four pages that Professor Brownlee devoted to the subject, and his treatise is, alas, typical. What did you get in those three or four pages? Basically saying only that international organizations sponsor treaties and institutionalized dispute settlers like the International Court of Justice interpret them, that there are I.O. venues, I.O. standing short for international organizations, such as the UN General Assembly, which is one more place that you can find either the state practice that might lend itself to custom or the opinio iuris that might lend itself to custom. And maybe a good place to look for things like the subsidiary evidence that we consider, such as the views of experts, might be the International Law Commission. This is typical. That is, trying to fit these institutions into the old sources of Article 38 of the ICJ. He also says, oh, yes, the practice of international organizations' organs may contribute to what he called the internal law of the organization, which what he meant is that sort of boring administrative law that only those international lawyers who work for these organizations ought to be interested in, such as the rules of procedure of these organizations or the privileges and immunities of its staff. And Brownlee makes it quite clear, and I'm just focusing on him, but lots of treatises do the same, that except for that great exception in the European Union, states had pretty much not delegated much lawmaking power to these organizations except on relatively insignificant matters of little consequence, like, for example, the rules governing civil aviation. And these were little coordination games where everybody had an interest in doing the things that they should, and it wasn't really affecting the areas of high politics, that is, security issues. And the second implication that came out of his book, as well as most other treatments at the time, are international organizations are relatively inoffensive but generally useful vehicles to promote international cooperation. And it reflects, I think, this treatment, certain positivist norms and their hold on the literature. And the idea is that a treaty remains a treaty even when that treaty creates an organization such as the UN Charter. That is, it's still a kind of contract between states subject to the same rules of treaty interpretation as all other treaties. That delegated lawmakings and global forms of lawmaking scarcely exist, and that basically the fundamental processes for making international law and the basic actors, that is, states, remain unchanged, despite the fact that we now have almost 300 international organizations and numerous institutionalized dispute settlers. So if you count them by not just the formal courts that we have, but the quasi-judicial ones, they approximate about 40 of them, and there's a chart in the book that talks about them. Now, my bottom line, and I've learned when giving this talk, that since attention tends to wander, the best thing is to give your punchline first. Here's the punchline. The thesis is quite simple, really. That is, the age of post-World War II institutions have had a profound effect on the sources of international law, the content, the legally relevant actors, producing very significant changes in how our conceptions of compliance and enforcement are, and as you see, new forms of challenges, vertical, horizontal, and ideological. Let me just briefly canvas this, and the rest of the talk will fill in a bit more. How have the sources changed? Well, the sources are very different. That is, we now have many more places to look to find legally relevant obligations, including of states. And it's not just treaties, custom, and general principles, as we learned, but that pedigree of those sources has changed. And we'll talk about some of those examples. The second change is the spectrum of legally binding authority is now a spectrum instead of an on-off switch. There is something, as Christine Chinkin has described in her work, a soft law. And I describe in the book how the conception of soft law, its many definitions, its many variants, are very much influenced by international organizations, and that I think in many ways they gave birth to soft law. And another change in those sources is that it's becoming increasingly difficult in many cases to point to state consent as the origin, except with great artificiality, in part because the consent on which some of these sources are based was given a long time ago or scarcely exists. Now, that's something about the sources has changed. The content of those sources has changed. That is, the very substance of international law has undergone some subtle and not so subtle changes. For example, we now have strong proponents of hierarchy of rights within international law. Some of those hierarchies are quite familiar to any student. Jus cogens, erga omnes obligations. And so the book talks about how jus cogens and erga omnes obligations are premised on a theory of community that is very much tied into the creation of post-World War II institutions, i.e. IOs. And it's not just that these organizations are nice vehicles for giving rise to jus cogens, which is, after all, found in the Vienna Convention on Law of Treaties, negotiated under UN auspices, and jus cogens in that treaty was very much the product of the fact that you had socialist states pushing for it, and a package emerged whereby the United States got some of the things it wanted in the rest of the convention for giving up on jus cogens. But there's also another reason why international organizations are responsible for hierarchy in not just the jus cogens erga omnes sense. That is, as we have proliferating international organizations producing yet more treaties, And states find themselves challenged by keeping up with even knowing what the treaties are, much less reporting under them. There is a great deal at stake in these organizations prioritizing within their own treaty regimes. So, for example, the International Labor Organization has come up with core labor rights. You can hear me even if I'm not.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Because it's.
Yeah,
let me know if you can't hear me when I. Oh, all right, so I'll go back to the pounding. So the International Labor Organization, as some of you may know, has created a list of core labor rights, and it is in part because it has been such a successful treaty machine over the years, producing some 170 or so treaties, that it has had to create a core conception, a hierarchy within its international labor code. How else has the content of international law changed? Well, there are new conceptions of sources or new conceptions of content that I think owe their existence to international organizations. The duty to cooperate, which is at the heart of criticisms of the United States, for example. The notion that you have to negotiate multilaterally before you do something unilaterally, which is affirmed, for example, in the Shrimp Turtle case in the WTO. That notion of multilateral negotiation before you act alone is very much premised on a community and very much premised on these organizations' existence and what they press for. Common but differentiated responsibilities is another example of what I think is a content-based rule that grows out of the turn to institutions. And generally, the proliferation of international law is not just a product of the proliferation of capital, ideas, people across borders, but these organizations, which themselves have bureaucratic and other reasons to produce more law, and they have done so, that is, at least on paper, quite successfully, so that we have a great deal of law that just their very existence and the very subject matter, which increasingly punctures the Article 2, 7 domestic jurisdiction notions so that it becomes an empty set over time, that public-private divide, where we once knew what international law was supposed to be about and it governed foreign relations among states, is gone, as well as the divide between international economic law and public international law, so that the substance of international law is now virtually everything that is covered by domestic law, and I think institutions have something to do with that. How are the change in actors, then, the legally relevant actors? Well, some of these, I think, are fairly obvious. We now know that non-governmental organizations are very much actors of enforcement and, in many cases, participate in the making of law. And we frequently think that international organizations and NGOs are sort of competitors. But actually, if we look at it more closely, there's a nice little symbiotic relationship between NGOs and IOs. They have been aiders and abettors of each other's participation far more often than they have been competitors. So that NGOs' very ability to participate is due to the observer status or consultative status they've been given, to the access they have otherwise enjoyed through documents or through other forms of participation, such as amicus, in briefs, and to a variety of other methods that they have been permitted access into the lawmaking process. But it's not just NGOs. Multinational corporations have enhanced their powers. And in my book, I discuss some of the sources of international law emerging within international organizations in which multinational corporations are the relevant actors. We'll talk about them in a minute. And, of course, international organizations themselves are autonomous actors as part of the, that's what the title is about. That is, my argument is they are no longer can simply be seen as the agents of a collective principle, that is, states, but they are autonomous for a lot of bureaucratic reasons that, among others, Weber would have understood. And international organizations as actors have not just been themselves actors, they have given birth to more international organizations, and not just formal ones, but subsidiary bodies. The sheer density of subsidiary bodies created by these organizations has complicated choices of where do you engage in treaty making or lawmaking. So they have created other organizations. They have also created a variety of individuals whose sheer existence is owed to the fact that international organizations now dominate. That is, experts, international civil servants, somebody called a secretary general, all of whom have somewhat different roles than either states or NGOs, but have their own claims to legitimacy or not. And so international organizations have even changed the very definition of what we used to call international organizations. They have softened the edges not just of law, but what is an international legal person? We used to know in the time of the reparation case that an international legal person was the only capable entity of acting. And the ICJ told us in that advisory opinion that the UN was such an actor, but you needed to be a person before you did that. Well, increasingly, we now have, for example, committees of the parties under environmental treaties that seem to act and quack just like an international legal person, except nobody wants to call them that, but they seem to have implied powers, benefit from the principle of effectiveness, and can even conclude treaties with other international legal persons. So that the very definition of international organizations is now much more contested than it was, and that's in part because of these organizations themselves. But the biggest change in the legally relevant actors is the states themselves. States are no longer what they were before these organizations were established. And the changes in states are perhaps the most fascinating of all, and many folks have written about this, not just me. But, for example, with respect to states, keep in mind that what we now think of as being an effective state is very much dependent on what organizations demand of states. You now are supposed to have national courts that are capable of enforcing intellectual property rules. You're now supposed to have an executive, a very strong executive, that is capable of negotiating trade rounds in the WTO and concluding them with efficacy and making them enforceable within your state. You now increasingly have national courts that talk to each other, including national courts that talk to each other in terms of what institutionalized dispute settlers are talking about. And, of course, many states have had to create agencies such as aviation departments to comply with what ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, demands, so that the very structure, the internal governmental structure, as well as the relative powers of executive branch, legislative branch, have been influenced by international organizations. Of course, if you are a reader of Anne-Marie Slaughter, she points to another change, and I think this change is also due in part to international organizations, that is the networking of parts of governments together. That is, national regulators, justice ministries talking to each other, or environmental ministries talking to each other, so that it becomes increasingly artificial to talk about states as a single entity, but increasingly makes sense to talk about the component parts of states. Those are some of the changes in the first part here. Producing, and I'll have to be briefer because I see my time, producing changes in compliance or enforcement. Here, this is stuff that I think you will find out there, but one change is a basic change in what the nature of sovereignty is itself, thereby changing what compliance means. Jays and Chays in the New Sovereignty told us that today sovereignty is status, membership in these organizations and in other regimes. And that means that we have now added to our toolkit in terms of compliance and enforcement. It used to be that you comply with sticks, coercion, or by being persuaded through reason to comply. Now we have at least a third, which is socialization. You are socialized over time to complying, and so you comply sort of like the teenager on the latest fad without thinking too much, simply because that is what is expected of you by this community that you belong to. And I'll talk about the challenges to all of this in a minute. Now, the challenges are far more interesting. After all, I saw the ad for this, and it talked about Frankenstein, so I better get to the challenges quite quickly. And that is, the turn to institutions has produced a wave of challenges, many of which I think are familiar to you. The vertical ones are the disconnect, or the reported disconnect, between the international level and the national level. And this is frequently stated in forms of democratic deficit. And of course, people talk about what a democracy is in at least three different ways. Some people think it's checks and balances. Some people define democracy by participation in electoral processes. Some people define democracies by enjoying substantive rights, such as due process, that at least used to be associated with democracy. But these differences in how we define democracy play out in how we criticize the democratic deficit and how we purport to fix it with respect to these organizations. So that some people concerned with checks and balances would want some form of checks and balances within these organizations, such as judicial review, or at least requiring two political bodies within these organizations of different membership to participate. Others would want to fix it through greater forms of participatory democracy. The most avid advocate would be adding NGOs in STIR. That is, international civil society participates more, thereby participation alone would enhance the democracy. Others claim that lack of respect for the rights of individuals is the key, so we must affirm, for example, due process rights when these organizations act. The second kind of change is a horizontal one, between states, and you're familiar with this as well. That is, concerns that IO forms of lawmaking, whether through the IMF, through strategic adjustment loans, the World Bank, through its guidelines, or the Security Council, through its resolutions on counterterrorism, all of that fails to respect sovereign equality and these organizations, and focusing on institutions tells us and shows us through these formal methods of enhancing the power of some states versus another. That connects to the last kind of series of challenges, which is ideological challenges. Thanks to these organizations, it is actually easier to find critique that international law and international forms of lawmaking in particular reflect dominant ideologies. And there are different forms of these ideological critiques. One, the dominant ideology of the West, affirming free markets and only some civil and political rights. The Washington Consensus made into an international organization. That is what the IMF is about. That is what some assert the World Bank is about. And that is certainly the kind of advice that gets you in into the status of being a full-fledged sovereign today. Another kind of ideological critique, some make it differently than others, is hegemonic exercises of power by the new hyperpower on the block since the end of the Cold War. But there are other forms of ideological critique. And with Christine Chenkin here, who can forget to mention gender critiques based on these organizations. That is, these organizations reflect the same gender biases and perhaps enhance them in some ways that we find among states. Guess why? Now, having laid out my thesis, let me lay out my caveats, okay? Because this talk is based on a rather hefty book. This is, Brownlee's three pages became 660, so I am vastly oversimplifying things. But let me just address the caveats first. I am not suggesting, for example, in the challenges that all of these are new challenges to international law, but I am suggesting that they take some novel forms of some very old challenges in the age of international organizations. The second thing I want to make sure you understand is I'm not trying to suggest that all international organizations make law to the same degree or in the same way. In fact, most of my book is to try to show how different organizations here address law and lawmaking in different ways, and that's part of the richness of the subject. So I'm not saying that, for example, the World Health Organization that is dominated by health practitioners with a strong, rather rational aversion to lawyers, does law the same way as the ILO, which is an international labor organization, which from the very beginning was premised on being a treaty machine, producing treaties after treaty. The World Health Organization is only starting to get into the law picture, certainly not in the same extent, but the SARS regulations and some of the health regulations see that organization jumping in, but at a much more reduced extent. I'm also not suggesting that they do law the same way. The World Trade Organization, as we know, produces trade rounds And those trade rounds leave delegated authority for its adjudicative body, the panels and the appellate body, to fill in. Not all organizations have that double mode of managerial treaty making dependent on a form of litigation. And so I'm not saying they produce it in the same way, and I'm not saying they all produce the same amount. And I'm also not suggesting, finally, that the only way to create international law is through an organization. My next project is on foreign investment. And foreign investment is an interesting regime to me precisely because, for the most part, it does not rely on a single or even many international organizations, but is produced through a series of bilateral investment treaties and some free trade agreements for the most part. So an international organization is not essential, but it does produce some characteristic forms of law. A sub-theme of the book is the title that Oxford, because it's not a good capitalist, rejected. That is, I wanted to entitle the book Governing the World, and they said that wasn't sufficiently academic, and therefore they rejected it. But the sub-theme is that most states of the world are rule takers, not rule givers, and that with some exceptions, that is, the United States and some very powerful states, but even those states are subject to some of these things, but most states of the world are, to a considerable extent, governed by what these organizations do and produce in many areas, including both mundane areas as well as the subject of high politics, including access to weaponry, control of their economies. Now, I'm not suggesting that international organizations were created in order to govern the world. I'm just suggesting this has been a gradual incremental effect produced by the fact that they have blurred the traditional distinctions between making law, interpreting it, and adjudicating it in the same way that our national institutions have blurred those distinctions. And it's no accident that at least on my side of the Atlantic, when we talk about law, it's filled with talking about institutions, the role of the presidency, the role of courts, the role of executive branches, generally agencies. And I think it's about time that we started thinking about international organizations that way. Now, just to show that I do theory too, that is, where am I coming from? I'm coming from some very standard traditions in terms of how we discuss these organizations, and my characteristic thing is to be a pragmatist and to borrow from all of these traditions in, I hope, what you have just heard. What are these traditions? Functionalism. This was the idea that international organizations are the products of interdependence and respond to specific state needs, and therefore serve those particular needs, so that each organization helps to address a particular need. The UN Security, IMF, Macroeconomics and Finance, the World Health Organization, the Global Cooperation on Health, and so on. If you want to see a live example of functionalism thinking in action, take a look at the ICJ's advisory opinion responding to the World Health Organization's request for use of weapons, nuclear weapons. You will see functionalism at its height in that organization. You, World Health Organization, stick to health. Now, I would think that health has something to do with nuclear weapons, but no, that's functionalism in its pure form. Now, keep in mind that some functionalists really thought that there was a possibility that these functionalist institutions would gradually start to blur their mandates and produce something more than they would produce. And that's why I put Mitrani there. Mitrani was an author who, at least by the end of his life, thought that it was possible through functionalism to produce what he called peace, P-E-A-C-E, through pieces. That is, these little organizations, each doing their own thing, would gradually produce what all good international lawyers want, for all of us to sing Kumbaya and get together and be peaceful. Now, realism is, of course, the very different take. That is, states, and here again, I'm talking about ideal types here. I'm very well aware different types of realists out there. That is, the realists, as I define them, states continue to rule. International organizations tend to be ruled by its most powerful member. That is at least what Hans Morgenthau said. And that there really is no risk of peace through pieces because we're still in a state of anarchy and with little pockets where states have agreed to cooperate through these organizations. What is interesting about the realists is, of course, they focus on power. and how even organizations can reflect power, particularly power of states. The disaggregationists break the state. States are not just those billiard balls, black billiard balls with single interests, especially on security, but there are component parts to states. And Anne-Marie Slaughter and her husband Andrew Moravchek is one example of a disaggregationist, but there are others. And these are people that look to interest groups within state, whether they're calling them epistemic communities because they want to talk fancy, or they're talking about interest groups, but they define them slightly differently. Some of them are technocratic groups, some of them are politically powerful groups, and that, the insight that is produced by this, is that if you want to understand what, quote, states do and what international organizations do, you need to understand the particular interest groups within states and how they may get to rule a particular organization or become quite powerful enough to create one of their own, see free traders and the WTO. Now, that's the disaggregationist, and they obviously take a different look at what a government is, and they define the role of the citizenry and the role of international civil society in a very different way. Critical theory, as I hope this place, I hope, is familiar with. We is talking about the panoply of great crits, David Kennedy, Marty Koskenniemi, Annan, and Matua. For some reason, even those who purport to talk about the third world tend to live in the first. But in any case, these are the folks who criticize international law and now international organizations on the premise of power, but also race, gender, ideology. That is, they attack the Eurocentric bias in the very creation of these organizations, what they were for. They challenged their neutrality, their claim to independence, their claim to simply be a neutral forum for playing out a neutral community position. They attack weighted voting, for example, in the IFIs. They attack the notion of what these organizations are really about. Constructivists, and here's Andy Wendt, and the Chase themselves, the crucial idea is that the arrows go both ways. Unlike the realists or the functionalists or even the disaggregationists, it's not just that states have preconceived ideas and therefore they create international organizations to help implement them, but that those creations of theirs, the international organizations, begin back to influence states themselves. So that the state's very notion of what they are, what their interests are, become changed through their participation in these organizations. Now, international lawyers love this last one especially because this helps to explain why, for example, a state that might be reluctant to get into a human rights regime begins buying into the idea after a while. So on the whole, international lawyers have not been very critical and sort of like this political science idea of constructionalist because it poses the notion that states can actually change over time. Now, with respect to the more specific things, how much time do I still have?
5 to 10 minutes.
Ah! All right, let's go faster. All right, here are some of the things, and I'm not gonna try to summarize the book, but just give you a sample of what some of the things that I'm talking about in terms of the changes, this more substantive changes in law. So I'm not talking just generalities. One is the changes in what a treaty is. And I promised that I said something that I would say something about a UN charter or the charters of these organizations. And there's a whole chapter on how the interpretation of what a charter of an organization is has changed into a three-ring circus in which all the political organs as well as courts are involved. And that these charters are now subject officially to the rules of treaty interpretation of the Vienna Convention, but that those rules are so malleable and manipulable that it is very easy to adapt these charters to the new needs. And so we get forms of institutional practice that change the very heart and soul of, for example, what a threat to the peace is, to cite the most common example. We also have the notion of implied powers growing out of a principle of effectiveness. And the notion of intent has changed from if anybody ever believed it, original intent of who drafted it, to sort of an ongoing notion of what it is that the intent of the current participants in the regime are, and it's frequently discussed at a very artificial, abstract level. One result is what many of us have called the mission creep of these organizations, so that these organizations had an original mandate, but now that mandate has transformed itself through the very changes in the definition of their charters, so that the World Bank, which was originally established to focus on infrastructure projects in states that were devastated by World War II, has now come to promote free trade, liberal capital flows, to promote the equitable income distribution within those states, environmental sustainability, to eliminate corruption, to promote tax reform and privatization. All of those are new mandates. The same could be said of other organizations, including the WTO. The other things that I focus on in this slide is the changes in treaty making. That is, now increasingly more than half of our multilateral treaties are being negotiated in international organizations, auspices, in venues, and they frequently take one or more of these forms. That is, treaty-making conferences in which we now know what the rules of procedure are, we have some costs involved in them, and voting is usually by, but not always, on the basis of consensus. And we rely on, for example, the UN Secretariat for final clauses such as reservations and so forth, and including the reliance on the Secretariat for what happens after a treaty is concluded, like whether or not you can file a reservation. Treaty making by experts in a variety of areas, not just the International Law Commission, but UNCENTRAL. We give the experts designated by these organizations first crack at these treaties, and they produce the first drafts of significant treaties, and they very much influence the final product. Managerial forms of treaty making, that is, framework conventions involving those committees of the parties or COPs or meetings of the parties. But also, I would argue, the WTO is another form of managerial treaty making where the gaps in the law are filled either through more subsequent treaty rounds, which are set out in advance, or through delegated decision makers. And treaty making with strings attached, what is that? That is, international organizations frequently say that you have to at least report what you do with respect to a treaty, including what your legislature has decided, whether or not you have decided to abide by it, and that's little strings attached. The International Labor Organization is one example. And the treaty spends some and the chapter spends some time talking about, well, has this enhanced both the number of treaties or their quality? And my argument is it certainly has enhanced the number of treaties. Why? Iteration, access to information, reduction of transaction costs, self-enforcing behavior, facilitation of path dependencies, elimination of free riders, creation of property rights, issue linkage, package deals. You know the scoop if you've read a single political science manual on what these organizations do. That is, all of these things tend to produce more treaties. It's possible to create a package deal when you have this. On the other hand, there are some instances in which turning to these organizations impedes cooperation. And that is when you choose the wrong international organization to go to, and that's known as forum shifting. That means that sometimes, and sometimes this is intended, it means that you will not succeed because you have gone to the wrong forum to negotiate a treaty. And sometimes an international organization is not successful at concluding a treaty because it, after all, is a bureaucracy and it shares the pathologies that Weber, among others, towards the end of his life, figured out. That is, bureaucracies have pathological problems. They are inefficient, ineffective, repressive, unaccountable, and sometimes even corrupt. There are adverse path dependencies, in other words. And so my bottom line is that they generally tend to enhance and make possible more treaties, but they sometimes may prevent it, sometimes consciously, by turning to the wrong international organization. But I'm also quite hedged, in fact, quite negative in some respects, on whether they have made treaties better. And here, I am familiar with Bruno Simas and others who suggested they reflect lowest common denominator formulations. The fact that we're in these huge forums with global participation tends to produce vaguer provisions with paper treaties. And the one hesitation I have about that is I'm not so worried about imprecise treaties if you've created some mechanism within the institution to fill in the vagaries. That is, if the treaty is not just vague and sits on a shelf, but if the treaty is part of what I would call a motion picture camera, a dynamic form of treaty making that is increasingly evident, where you've attached some institutions to fill in the gaps, then I'm not so worried about lack of precision. We tend to look at treaties in the past, snapshots in time. International organizations at least encourage, in some occasions, looking at a treaty over time as a motion picture camera to see whether the precision is ultimately enhanced over time. Now, I obviously don't have time to talk about all these other forms of international organizations law that are addressed in the book, but let me just go to the bottom line, which is that they are producing what I would call, and many others have suggested, like Benedict Kingsbury at my rival school that I never mentioned, global administrative law. That is, what we're talking about increasingly is law that looks very much like the kind of law you would see in the administrative state. And therefore, they're characterized by different attempts at checks and balances, as I've mentioned, but also attempts at more at interesting administrative approaches to procedural participation, to justifying legitimacy of this law through reasoned practice and reasoned decision-making, and through adherence to standards. What's interesting about them is that and I use each of these examples to highlight a particular point in the book, but some of them involve the very active cooperation, some would say co-optation, of multinational enterprises who are very much involved in the creation of the law, Codex Alimentarius, the food additives regime, for example, and some would say they have captured this form of international regulation. And to that extent, it reproduces at the international level things that our domestic colleagues have for long discussed in terms of administrative law, the role of expertise and whether we should rely on experts, the role of checking the role of experts and who should do that, the question of review. And ICAO is a perfect example, the ICAO Standards and Recommended Practices of, and I use that to show that it's not a mere cooperation regime, that is, that it slides into a counterterrorism regime, depending on which part of ICAO you focus on. So that it is, in very much, reflective of this tension between, the lack of tension, that is, the blurring of the high end of politics as well as the low, as well as a blurring of how we enforce it. ICAO, for example, is enforced by carrots, reporting obligations. That's all it's stated, after all, in the charter. But there are also subtle sticks being used to conform to ICAO. That is, if you don't conform to ICAO's aviation practices, you may be denied a permission to land by a national airport. If you don't incorporate their standards into national law, then you may face other severe consequences, like, for example, not having an aviation treaty with the United States. And there are much other forms of indirect incorporation of ICAO standards, so that now, for example, the Security Council's regime on counterterrorism incorporates, as a Chapter 7 notion of best practices, ICAO standards. So it is much more of a merger of a variety of things. And let me just end on this note, which is this wonderful slideshow lets me put all this stuff up, and if you want to see where I got it from, that's Orly Lobel, the Renew Deal, at the very top of the page at 89 Minnesota Law Review. Now, she was talking about the new form of administrative regulation in Europe and the United States, not about international law. But what's interesting is how much of what she says applies to international law. So I've simply taken the new forms of what she called democratic experimentalism on the right and put my title, IO Governance, to suggest that the new forms of governance that we're seeing, including through many of the things that I just put on the board, ICAO standards, securities regulation, and so forth, is a very different nature of international law. The old international law that we carry around in our heads, centralized, command and control, rigid and fixed, uniform rules, generalized, the new, fuzzy, soft, all this wonderful stuff we like to talk about, is characterized by all those wonderful characteristics on the left-hand side. Decentralized, coordination, orchestration, flexible, adaptable. Who could want anything more? I mean, right? It is just wonderful, and it goes on. The lawmaking process is dynamic, iterative, repeat learning, experimental, promotes innovation, ongoing benchmarking is the key. We don't have to go to courts, which is very much a problem. Okay, now, you can tell by my tone, I am skeptical, and I think that very much the forms of IO governance that we see at that one side of the page very much reflects now a second generation of thinking about these organizations. We are now quite more skeptical about these organizations, and that's why the title of the talk in the last chapter is The Promise and Perils of International Organization. And my argument there is quite simple. That is, the very thing that made us as international lawyers so hopeful about turning to these organizations, their promise of centralization, their promise of independence, and the fact that they made all of these things possible, adjudication of disputes to punish lawbreakers without violence through discursive shaming techniques, for example, not reliant on adjudication, and socialize others into compliance. All of that have now been cast in doubt, not just by the crits, but by those who study these organizations. And so the critics of these organizations suggest, and I'm just picking the hegemonic critique as an example, is that a lot of these things that I've just mentioned, the forms of lawmaking processes, decentralization, the reliance on soft law, for example, is a convenient tool for a hegemonic law that can be imposed more easily on others, precisely because it doesn't have the formal structures of the old Article 38 sources of law, and that the expressive power of organizations, the shaming techniques, for example, is a wonderful technique, a new one, to create an old thing that Professor Simpson has talked about, that is outlaw states. That is, we now have new internationally sanctioned, international organizations sanctioned rules for creating the other. Rogue nations, sometimes very good effect, and sometimes we doubt what it's being used for. The same with respect to compliance. It's wonderful that we have socialization as a new technique, but if the form of socialization takes the form of conditionality or a forum shifting so that the hegemon picks the right forum in which to negotiate a treaty to benefit its interests or to cause a treaty to collapse, then we have a form of exercise of power through these organizations. And, for example, we have the criticism that these organizations are now being used as tools of privatized law. That is, the very incorporation of multinational enterprises can be criticized that way. And then socialization. What's so good about socialization, say the critics, if it's hegemonic socialization? That is, if the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank tells states how to be better market states and basically says to them, this is the only way you can govern your economy by making sure you adhere to the Washington consensus, even though we may have some doubts about whether that leads to sustainable development or greater gaps between rich and poor or regional dislocations of wealth, then that is a kind of socialization that some would say we don't want. So that's the reason that the chapter begins with what I think is suggested in your introduction, and I'm getting too old to read from the book because the print is so small. Frankenstein was intended to be a cautionary parable for those who dare to assume the prerogatives best left to God. Shelley condemns the pursuit of solitary individual idealism in defiance of collective humanitarianism. That's what the book is really about. I didn't know that when I first saw Frankenstein, but that's what it's about. Her novel, though, today serves as a cautionary tale for those who extol collective humanitarianism, including the idealistic advocates of post-World War II international organizations, since it suggests that agents may not always heed their principles and that the deeds, real or imagined, of agents can wreak havoc on both master and servant. Thanks. Yes, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just coming from some of your examples, like say Juice Kogan's as an example of sort of the source of international human rights law, for example,
right.
Or the dispute resolution of the UN, thinking about small states and big states and that kind of judiciability, or for example, the TRIPS legislation looking at access to intellectual property rights and essential medicines. Is it not that the underdog could win? I was with you all the way till the end, but
right.
It does. I mean, am I too idealistic to think that in my generation this will mean that there's more of there's more of them than there are of us, and that things like hunger and access to medicines could be eradicated by the idea that everybody is accountable to everybody else. We can see what we do.
No, and I ready concession. The book itself actually ends on an optimistic note, in which I say, well, these forms of governance that I'm talking about here, this stuff, can actually be a lot more better than the old forms that we're used to, precisely because at least all states are involved, right? So that one way of coming to this optimistic conclusion is relative to what, right? And if you're comparing these new forms of governance to the 19th century, in which there was one big European power who decided who to invite to their favorite treaty conferences, looked out and invited their friends. Nobody else, the uncivilized world, need not apply. Then it's better than that, right? And I think that some of the examples that you've cited, including the soft law in the Doha Round that says states are free to get generic drugs, was a hard-fought battle, by the way, with some predictable villains on the other side, right? But I think that taking a look at that battle through the institutional eye of what the WTO contributes to it is what my book is about. That is, I think the nature of the battle, who won and who lost, is very much a story about the WTO as an institution. So that either way you go, optimist, the glass is half full, or pessimist, it's half empty, right? I win. International organizations matter. Juice Kogan's, though, for example, just to suggest the glass may be not quite as full as you think. Who cites Juice Kogan's? It seems to be that international organizations of a rather predictable stripe cite it. That is, the Human Rights Committee talks about it, right? Who actually practices it? Who actually cites it to each other as states? And there, I think part of the story is the rather weak nature of our international organizations designed to enforce Juice Kogan's. The good side is we created the concept, as I just suggested, and it is very much a child of the turn to institutions. The bad thing is the weaknesses of its enforcement is also the child of those institutions. Is that sufficiently ambiguous? Good. Yeah. No. I think we're all in the business of trying to provoke in a talk like this. So I do, on the whole, tend to agree with you. However, I think that wonderful progress narrative that international organizations are all about, that we created them starting in, earlier than World War II, but certainly at a mass after World War II, in this strong push for the notions, reviving the League of Nations idea that this was the very essence of scientific progress and that codification of law would bring us gradually through peace, through pieces, right? I think we've lost a little bit of that faith. Now, Marty Koskenniemi thinks it's all a fraud now. And one of the most depressing things about his wonderful book, General Civilizer of Nations, is he seems to say it's over. That is, we can no longer look ourselves in the mirror and really believe that anymore. That is, that we're always on the side of the angels, that our institutions and our law are always on the side of doing good, is, I think, once you take a look at these institutions, a little more questionable than they were 50 years ago. Oh boy, I've silenced everybody.
Well, can I just follow up on that last question about not so much whether the glass is half full or half empty, but how good a quality wine have you actually put in it in the first place? Not you personally, as ever, generally. Why is it that international organizations are viewed by so many people as this tremendously progressive force in society when they have themselves nothing in the way of democratic accountability, generally very undemocratic working methods with a system of allocating jobs on a sort of jobs for the boys basis, of committee structures devised very much around power blocks rather than around any kind of serious representation. When decisions there are the product of a mixture of states, many of whom are not democratic, and let's be quite honest, those that are tend in international organizations to be at their least democratic in the way that they behave. Why is it that this is seen as so much more progressive than anything else? Is it perhaps that it's easier for the likes of you and me and many of those here to find employment and a ready voice, a ready audience in international organizations than we find elsewhere?
I'm shocked by that suggestion. Actually, I have not worked for an international organization, but I have worked for the alternative, and it's not pretty. That is, I've worked for the State Department, right? And if that's the alternative to global institutions of not-so-democratic states all engaging in discourse, that this is the question of compared to what, right? So that the focus here is very much on the kinds of institutions you criticize. That is, these are not regional organizations I'm talking about. I'm talking about global ones. And it's interesting, in the United States, the world of international organizations comes heavily loaded with ideological dice. That is, some people only praise a particular kind of organization of this stripe, the WTO and the IFIs. The others are criticized on the grounds that you have just described, right? And I'm interested in just why the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank escapes the criticism that you have rather reasonably lodged against, I think, the UN. And I think that if you pay attention to some of those folks living in the non-democratic world, they suggest that some of the structures and some of the rules that they are told they have to abide by, even though they are purported to be to enhance democracy, are not always having that effect. And therefore, they would criticize those other institutions on some of the same bases, but perhaps for the different ideological conception. But that doesn't answer your question. I think the question is really about the faith that international lawyers have always had in discourse, in the notion that if we get enough states together and other relevant actors, NGOs, and subparts of states together, that discourse alone is helpful, and that over the long haul, they will produce something that is more helpful than the lack of discourse or the dictate of power. Now, I'm as good a critic of Habermas as the next guy. Discourse is power-based discourse. What is not discussed is as important as what is discussed. But still, I do agree, I think, and that's where my faith in international law still resides, that I'd rather have talk, including among the non-democratic, than not. And that a league of democracies to replace the UN is not going to produce the kind of resolution to fundamental issues like, for example, terrorism, as at least the best hopes that we have with respect to an organization that includes all kinds of states. So universal participation is still worth the candle.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to know, because you didn't have much time to talk about the perils because of the time constraint.
Yes.
So the question is, when you talk about the perils, do you also analyze the case of soft law being actually being being transformed in hard law, but in the domestic arena. When countries, and I agree with your idea with hegemonic lawmaking, so you go to those conferences of the parties of MEAs, for example, you have actually 10 delegations negotiating, and the rest is just watching and actually not even understanding what it is about. So so that countries will go actually to an international organization, which is the wrong one, as you mentioned. So for example, taking a trade issue, going to an MEA, and then taking a result, for example, a soft law decision from the conference of the parties, and then using it as a foundation for a domestic hard law instrument that is going to affect trade interests of other parties. So I'd like to know if you cover this, because I'm actually studying this thing, that's why I'm being so detailed. And a provocative second question would be, somebody mentioned Jules Colgan's. Don't you believe that actually Jules Colgan's can also be used as a hegemonic instrument, because you will have to determine which states are going to determine its content, and maybe it won't be related, for example, to the demands from developing countries, for example.
Right, and I want to be able to I'm going to stare around the podium and still use the mic. Just on the last, I mean, one of the problems with Jules Colgan's that I didn't address in my earlier, it's not just a lack of enforcement, it's a lack of content. You and I know that there is an article for every notion on earth that is a plausible candidate for Jules Colgan's. It is the Superman of norms. It's everybody's favorite norm to pour into. And it's precisely its lack of content or agreed content that potentially gives it the same problem as you discussed with soft law. The reason softness is appealing is because then, in some areas, and you're suggesting some, power can step in to give the soft norm greater hard edge. And you've mentioned some of those examples, and I do discuss some of those in the book, so that the softness of many of these standards, of these, it's interesting to see which ones of these are picked up by the World Trade Organization regime, like this one, this one is picked up, as well as the Codex Alimentarius is picked up, right? And it gives a very hard edge. It's interesting that the biggest candidate for soft law, the soft opinions of human rights bodies, for example, or the plethora of decisions rendered by these six treaty bodies, all under the UN, are not given that hard edge, right? So it's that choice, right? And that's what is a, quote, problem with reliance on soft. The same thing, though, occurs with respect to the hard stuff, Security Council resolutions, right? In the book, I talk about a whole chapter on the Security Council as a tool of power for both good and evil. And Security Council resolutions are a perfect dynamic between soft and hard. 1373, use of force under shadow of Afghanistan is a perfect example. It says, but in the soft part, that a non-state actor can create an armed attack. That if you happen to be a non-state actor in a state that acquiesces in that act, that host state is now also the subject of self-defense. And that you still have self-defense, not just when the armed attack occurs, but later, right? So we're getting closer, not yet preemptive, but boy, is it stretching the notion. But it's all in the soft part, right? Of a Security Council resolution that is about terrorism, right? And there's lots of hard stuff in it, which I talk about. But it's interesting that that soft part gives the US the capability of now citing, and it routinely cites 1373, including, by the way, my favorite citation, footnotes to the torture memos of the administration, to assert, of course, we're at a war. Of course, it's a global war on terrorism. Of course, it's a war against states that acquiesce. And of course, it ain't over, right? So that the softness of that preambular language of the Security Council resolution is a perfect tool of what I've called hegemonic international law.
Right, so yeah, okay, right up there.
Thank you. I don't know if this is, oh, it is on, thanks. I'd actually like to ask a question coming more from a political science perspective.
And this is filled with allusions to political science. I don't claim to be one.
Well, this is a very general question. I don't really claim to be one either. But I was thinking about international law and its relationship to power. You've obviously talked about international law as an instrument of hard power. But I think one of the interesting things to me, and I don't know whether you agree with this, is perhaps a change in international law as a source of power, perhaps more at the domestic level, because I think definitely one change that's happening is that international law is permeating into sort of the national discourse in domestic legal structures. It's definitely politically a sort of yardstick of legitimacy and is referred to a lot by politicians, even talking to their own populace, just in terms of sort of domestic issues. And also, obviously, on the societal level, as a sort of element of discourse in societal conflict and in reform and other things like that. So if you sort of see those two faces of the power of international law, I mean, I wondered if you agreed with me that, that's kind of a change. And if so, is that dichotomy reproduced within international organizations, do you think?
There's a section in the book in which I talk about Joe Nye's concept of soft power, in which he says the part of power of the United States, it's its soft power, its rhetorical stance and so forth, and not just its rhetoric, but the soft way it exercises its power. And I address international organizations in very much the same way, and I think that they become part of the soft power of the United States on one level, but they also have their own soft power. When the Secretary General said, after the second Security Council resolution removing peacekeepers from ever going to the International Criminal Court, if you're not a peacekeeper from a state that has already ratified one, and said, you know what, given what we just saw in the paper in Abu Ghraib, I don't think it's a good idea to exempt U.S. peacekeepers from the International Criminal Court. That was the soft power of the Secretary General, not always exercised, but sometimes deployed, and in this case, it had an effect. The U.S. lost, and at the third time around, that Security Council resolution was not renewed. That's an example of the soft power, in this case, an international organization official doing the work that I think the soft power that you described. But there was something else in your remark that I'm trying to remember I wanted to pick up on. Yeah. Right, no, and I think that that's true as well, and I think that where you get that international law from, the fact that it is a product of a universal institution with claims to universality, which in some parts of the world that matters a great deal, means that you get a certain oomph out of it. Look, the Bush administration is not known as a multilateralist administration. However, when it comes to counterterrorism, and you look at what it's done with the Security Council, it has relied on the Security Council's soft and hard power to convince states that counterterrorism is in their interest and that this is not just a U.S. war on terrorism, but it's an international community effort. And so the latest report by the high-level body at the UN, as well as the Secretary General's body on UN reform, very much endorses that. And that's very valuable to the United States and to anyone that thinks terrorism is a serious problem. But that's where you get both the centralization and the independence, the two factors that I think trigger a lot of the UN's, for example, strength as a lawmaker, used in this soft way.
Okay, it's time for two more questions. I'm going to ask them. So the first is isn't it a bit puzzling that this proliferation of public international institutions has happened at the international level at precisely the same moment when we've almost entirely lost faith in public institutions at the domestic level? So we're told that we don't need as much government as we used to, and we've moved to privatization, deregulation. Precisely at that moment, we have all this. That's the first question. The second question, you might think is unfair, but what's the difference between this thesis and Anne-Marie Slaughter's thesis?
Oh, God!
I say that having read her book, but not having read your book yet.
Right. I'm negative.
Is it that you have more faith in public institutions?
No. Well, let's start with the second one. I read A New World Order as a very much a proponent of a new world order. That is, Anne Marie thinks that this trans regulation of government networks is on the whole a good thing, and that it could be made more accountable. And my own view is, if you do a close reading of my book, is that you would be a little bit more negative about her world as well as mine. That is, I think if you're conscious of power, if you're conscious of the ideological critiques I've enumerated, if you're conscious of and worried about democratic deficit in a way that says it's not just add more experts and NGOs and stir, then you should be worried about both her new world order as well as the one that I'm describing. The other thing I would say is that there are little portions of Slaughter's book in which she acknowledges that her world very much exists alongside of international, traditional international organizations, and that many of the networks that she's describing draw their power from or are enforced alongside with formal international organizations. I will say, take one issue with you, and that is I am not suggesting that we are now currently in the same mode of proliferation of formal new international organizations that we were, say, 15 years ago. In fact, there's been a small decrease in the number of formal international organizations. What we do see is an incredible density in the subsidiary bodies created by them, so that at last count, the Security Council had created, I believe, 6 different subsidiary bodies, all charged with counterterrorism. And if you talk to the experts on this, they're all working ostensibly for one body, the UN Security Council. They're all in New York. But they don't know what each other is doing, because that's the nature of a bureaucracy. And that proliferation creates the risk of inefficiency. And another problem that I think states officials are very much worried about is overburdened treaty making here and reporting obligations. The U.S. State Department now complains that it cannot keep track of all the various reporting obligations it has. Now, if the U.S. State Department, with nearly 200 lawyers devoted to this stuff, can't do it, can you imagine Bangladesh, right? So this suggests the uneven playing field that is out there in the guise of creating a more level playing field, because we sold these regimes on the premise of creating a more level playing field. Now we see that there are now second and third generation ways of dealing with this, so that now some states are calling into question whether the WTO appellate body is really a level playing field. Because when we actually take a look at who brings disputes, how heavily lawyered it is, what kind of claims win and lose, the U.S. loses, and Europe loses as well, but it's very much a U.S.-Europe game, right? So that, the same with ICSID and investment disputes, so that what we're now seeing then is very much the kind of critique that you see with privatization, in which some of these regimes reflect the privatization critique. Keep in mind, ICSID, this is the World Bank's settlement of investment disputes. What does it do? It settles disputes between private investors and states. We have opened the door to investors to sue directly states for violation of their investment obligations, right? This turns it over to private parties, business groups, to be the private attorneys general of this regime. They are going to enforce it. They're going to be the ones claiming and pushing the outer window on what fair and equitable treatment means, on what expropriation means, right? They are the ones, and this is much more than the WTO, which after all is screened by governments as to what kinds of claims are being brought. That is privatization of dispute settlement in a way that I think should bring both praise and pause. Praise, in one hand, because, hey, this looks like the human rights regime. Pause, because it's human rights regime for a particularly privileged class and a human rights regime that is very strong in a country that has managed, the U.S., that has managed not to subscribe to hard human rights obligations in other forums, so that the very kinds of claims that we might see against these corporations are not subject to international dispute settlement.
Okay, before we thank Jose, let me first of all invite you all up to the drinks reception on the fifth floor. I also want to thank the Shimizu Fund and the Law Department for helping us put this lecture together. And I also want to thank Chennai Tucker, who's sitting there in the middle row,